Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. And this is the second last episode for the year. 2020 is nearly done, and thank God for that. 2020 can get in the bin, as far as I'm concerned. In just a moment, we'll be walking through the week's security news with Adam Boileau, who is back in the news seat this week. And then we'll be hearing from Mark Rogers in this week's sponsor interview. Mark is Okta's Executive Director of Cybersecurity. He is also heavily involved with the CTI League, a group of InfoSec professionals who banded together early this year to try to do good. They are cyber do-gooders. They've certainly chalked up some wins and helped out a bunch of organizations over the year. And in the process, Mark and his compadres have also been in a good position to observe changes and trends in the ransomware landscape. So he'll be joining us in this week's sponsor interview to talk through that. That is coming up later. But first up, of course, it is time for a check of the week's security news with our good friend, Adam Boileau. And Adam, we're going to start off by talking about a little bit of analysis that actually came out of Risky Biz. Brett Winterford published yesterday's newsletter, and leading the newsletter was a look at what's happening with ransomware insurance. Now, this was spurred on by a DM that I got, actually, you know, just from a guy here in Australia who said, you know, we got talking about ransomware and stuff. He said, by the way, you know, ransomware is doing funny things to cyber insurance premiums, and this is all going to be a bit of a problem. So I said to Brett, you know, maybe we could look into this because it's been a quiet news week and see if we could turn anything up. And sure enough, Brett was able to really substantiate that claim. There is trouble in cyber insurance paradise.
Yeah, it makes a whole bunch of sense when you see it laid out like Brett did in the newsletter. I mean, we've seen a real growth in ransomware and business email compromise, I guess. Those two kind of financially focused incentives for people to break into environments. And then cyber insurance has been a thing that people have been buying without a really clear idea of what it's for. I mean, some of the like NotPetya and big things like that.
Well, I think the problem is more that the insurers don't quite know what it's for rather than the people buying the policies, right? We're just seeing a blowout in what they're paying because they cover the ransoms. Often they cover extortion, you know, as part of these policies. And that means that they're getting hosed.
Yeah, I mean, certainly the world has changed underneath both, you know, network operators, normal people, and the insurance companies, because it just wasn't like this a couple of years ago, or, you know, 3 or 4 years ago. Yeah, and the insurers are stuck paying for, you know, a real growth industry for cybercrime. I mean, there's a lot of money sloshing around, you know, in ransom payments and all these other sorts of things. It kind of makes sense that, you know, insurance policies don't change quickly, you know, and the whole business model is kind of, you know, meant to support a relatively static world, right? I mean, the chance of an earthquake, a chance of, you know, some other natural disaster that you're insuring against, pretty static. Whereas the ransomware world and cybercrime, you know, it's just, you know, it changes all the time and they are, you know, struggling to catch up. And some of the approaches that we've seen, you know, kind of pushing out, you know, better security practices and things out to customers to try and make them less likely to need to claim and then try to be able to reduce the impact when people do get compromised. You know, those are things that we as an industry have been trying to do for, you know, for ages and haven't really succeeded at. And I guess, you know, the idea that insurers would succeed where other people haven't, I mean, clearly they haven't, right?
So, well, and funnily enough, I mean, you would think that the insurance coverage would actually motivate more ransomware because all of a sudden people are just going to say, and I've seen interviews with CISOs where they're like, oh yeah, we paid the ransom because we had insurance. Do you know what I mean?
Exactly,
like,
right?
Whatever.
Yeah, and feeds back in a way that just isn't sustainable for someone, right? It's either not sustainable for the organizations paying premiums, or it's not sustainable for insurers, or it's not sustainable for cyber criminals. And clearly, the cyber criminals are doing pretty well out of this, and the insurers are gnashing their teeth.
One thing that occurs to me is that the insurance lobby would be really pushing the US government to sanction more of these ransomware crews, right? So they've got a reason not to pay out, because that is a thing that they're running into. They can't. The insurance companies can't pay the evil corp guys. Like, that's just not happening.
Yeah, and it's funny in a way, because you do wonder whether like the net result of this whole rather uncomfortable process, you know, would be an overall improved ecosystem. Like, if we can't give money to ransomware operators, then that would be probably a net good, right? And if insurers make people do things better, then maybe that would be a net good. But it's just
going to
be
very... that's a wonderful idea in theory, but what it would probably result in is like Garmin wouldn't exist anymore, you know?
I'm trying to be glass half full about insurance.
But look, the upshot here is that basically, you know, we expect that ransomware coverage is either going to be a separate policy or a tick-the-box option, and it's going to be insanely expensive. So this is what insurance companies will do. You know, they'll make it too hard. They'll say, oh, of course we offer this coverage, but here's what you have to do to get it, right? And it will just be impossible. It won't be workable.
I mean, they got to do something, right? I mean, some of the stats that Brett managed to dig up were, you know, that premiums would need to go up, you know, 20 to 30% a year to keep up with the cost of the insurers paying out, which, you know, that's, people are just not going to, yeah, as you said,
and that's the projection now, right? Yeah. Like, and this stuff is accelerating. So you sort of wonder, you know, what would happen to that number. Look, and it clearly hit a nerve, because like we got a lot of feedback pretty much immediately on this item. And my favorite bit of feedback came from a vendor guy that I know. And he wrote in and said that your observation about the cyber insurance business directly lines up with what I've seen from insiders. And he says, 2018, quote, cyber insurance is growing 40% year on year. We overcharge people and it's awesome since nobody knows what it should cost. I want to partner with you to differentiate my offering. And that has changed now to 2020 FML. This business is horrible. I need to partner with you so my customers' breaches are less costly to me. Right? So, yeah. And it's, and, you know, Brett made the point too that it's kind of Ponzi, it's been Ponzi style growth. Like the early losses from this ransomware stuff have been offset by the number of new policyholders coming into the mix, but someone's going to be left holding the bag, right?
Exactly, yeah. Like the world has just kind of changed out from underneath, you know, how they thought it was going to go a couple of years back. And yeah, you're right. Like that whole kind of Ponzi scheme aspect to it really makes it look quite unsustainable in its current state. And I guess, you know, if you're a, you know, CISO at a healthcare place and you're trying to get cyber insurance that covers ransomware in the US at the moment, I imagine that that is going to be a very, very rough time.
Well, if you could do it now, right?
Well, yeah. Like, if you've got a renewal clause, take it.
Yeah. Are we about to stimulate a massive run on the last of the cyber insurance policies? Anyway, well, the ones that include extortion anyway. But look, we're going to talk about a New York Times story now. And this one, look, there's elements of this story that are fantastic. It's got a real human interest element to it. The New York Times spoke to people at a hospital in Vermont that had been badly affected by a ransomware incident. But the story is a bit of a mixed bag.
Yeah, the story goes into, I think we talked about it a few weeks ago, the ransomware attack on the Vermont Medical Center, University of Vermont Medical Center. And they were, you know, in full shutdown because of the ransomware, you know, that was deployed in the network. And the story goes through, you know, talking to some cancer nurses who were involved with, you know, trying to give treatment to people in the middle of this process and having to turn people away from being, you know, potentially life-saving treatments. And yeah, the human impact of that is really laid out in a way that, you know, it's heartbreaking, you know, seeing people whose job it is to care for people, you know, have their workplace and their lives interrupted, and all the people who aren't getting care. And, you know, that's a really, really hard read. And then the story kind of veers off into talking about the motivations for the attack. And this is where, you know, I guess things are become a little bit less clear.
Well, yeah, okay. So the New York Times asserts that the victim here says that they did not receive a ransom demand. We do not believe that that is the case. Okay, so the story is pushing the line, which is popular with various people whose businesses rely on them having visibility into the operations of things like TrickBot, right? So Cyber Command coming in and messing with the status quo made them unhappy, right? So they're the ones who've been pushing the line that what we're seeing, these attacks against hospitals, are the TrickBot and ransomware operators lashing out and performing these things as destructive attacks, and it's not about money anymore and whatever. But look, we've spoken to sources with good access to information on this, and they say, yeah, there was absolutely a ransom demand. So it just seems like there is a line that is popular out there with in certain quarters that, oh no, Cyber Command shouldn't disrupt these operations because that's really bad. It's going to make them angry and make them, you know, just lash out and conduct these destructive attacks. But it really, from what we can gather, that is not what happened in this case. This was a straight up normal everyday ransomware attack.
And it's certainly not unusual for organizations that have been subject to ransomware to not come out and immediately say, hey, we got ransomed, right? A lot of the time it is kept quiet while they're negotiating.
Yeah, but this story actively pushes the line that it's, hang on, let me read from it. I mean, they've got a quote here from a guy saying it makes it seem like it was meant to be a disruptive attack rather than a profit-seeking one. We also didn't see the disastrous Armageddon attack that coming against 400 hospitals, and they're going to lash out like wounded animals and, oh no, it's the end of the world. And what we did see is normal for profit ransomware attacks against against facilities like UVM, which is the one we're discussing, right? So I think we need to be really careful about buying into certain narratives on this one, right? Like, let's wait for some actual proof.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty sane position to take, because there is, you know, there's so much uncertainty in this in this cyber world, and yeah, the narrative that there is a big enemy coming to do a bad thing, that plays well, for audiences that need that. And yeah, we just,
well, their line is, their we line don't is, know, right? Their line is Cyber Command shouldn't have done anything because it's going to make the bad people angry and lash out, right? Because they don't want to lose. They don't want to lose their visibility on things like TrickBot operations, right? They don't want to be evicted because Cyber Command came up and shook things up, right? So you just got to factor that in, I think, when you're reporting on this stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree, right? I mean, it did seem a little bit weird, and it didn't unfold like some of those narratives were predicting. And yeah, you're left kind of wondering, what agenda is being served.
Yeah, and I don't think these people are doing this maliciously. I don't. I just think they view the world a certain way, and it sort of skews the way they think about this stuff, right? So, and you've got to factor that in. Moving on, and yeah, look, we do have a piece here from CyberScoop on TrickBot. They're saying, oh, it's sputtering back towards full health, but then the story doesn't really substantiate the headline. I think it's just too early to say what the long-term impact against TrickBot has been. And of course, we don't know if there are further actions being taken against those operators in the background right now. So yeah, hard to know.
Yeah, exactly right. And the, when you see someone like Cyber Command operating, against an adversary, like we're only going to see a fraction of it as a technically observable kind of set of things where we can figure out what happened. And there's quite likely to be other aspects to the operation, or, kind of human side things, technical things, operational sort of things, right? You're not going to go at it in one way and then, that's it, right? It's more, they're a little more sophisticated than that. So yeah, it's hard to extrapolate from, pretty limited visibility.
Yeah. Well, Cyber Command don't do human, right? Right? But I think we're going to know in 6 months. Like, I think we're every week I'm seeing a story about like the status of TrickBot, right? And I think it's just too early to know. We're just going to have to wait a little while, and then we will know better.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Meanwhile, Chris Krebs having an interesting week. So he appeared on 60 Minutes. I watched the full segment. He did really well, said sensible things. And then a lawyer for the president, Joe DiGenova, who apparently acts for the president, as best we can tell, he is actually one of the president's lawyers, appeared on a radio call-in show and said the following.
Anybody who thinks that this election went well, like that idiot Krebs, who used to be the head of cybersecurity.
Oh, yeah, the guy that was on 60 Minutes last night.
That guy is a class A moron. He should be drawn and quartered, taken out at dawn and shot.
So there we have it. Wow. A lawyer for the United States president suggesting that Chris Krebs, a lifelong Republican, mind you, should be taken out at dawn and shot. I mean, I knew the crazies were going to come for him, but I did not expect them to be lawyers acting for the president. I should have expected this, right? But I didn't.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, it's hard to watch, what a complete mess everything is over there. And it's just, like, I can't imagine that happening in, Australian politics or New Zealand politics, right? The idea that you would be suggesting that someone who used to work for you, like, a week ago, should be shot or hung and drawn.
This is the sort of stuff they say in tin pot dictatorships, you know what I mean?
Exactly,
like, it's
right?
just
exactly.
appalling. So you wonder what's going to happen. I mean, Chris did an interview with the Today Show talking about, he's got some lawyers on this stuff. But I don't know that there's much they can do.
Well, no, right? And that's what's really rough. Like, if this was a normal person being, having, death threats made against them in a public forum, and it wasn't so political, then maybe you'd have some recourse. But here, I don't know what he can do about it, right? You just have to kind of take it as part of the job, right? Which is super rude, especially now he's not even getting paid for it.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's what do you even say? Anyway, Chris, if you're listening, hope you're holding up okay and the crazies aren't giving you too much of a bad time. Ocean Lotus, we've got some interesting research here on Ocean Lotus, the Vietnamese APT crew. Microsoft has published some research pointing out that these guys, they're dropping crypto miners these days. And the thinking seems to be the reason they're dropping crypto miners is so when people roll incident response, they're like, kids with their crypto miners and just, leave it at that. And that seems like a sensible strategy.
I mean, that makes a lot of sense to me. I mean, that kind of misdirection is absolutely a thing that hackers do. And, you know, if you know you're going to be responded on, then it makes sense to give them something to find so that you can keep the other thing that you're doing, you know, out of sight. And, yeah, pretending to be a script kiddie with a crypto miner. And, like, if they – I mean, some of the suggestion was, oh, my God, they're – you know, they've switched to the North Korean model of, you know, also making money on the side, or, the, you know, the Chinese model making money on the side, or the North Korean model of funding your economy through crypto mining. But, yeah, like, the fact that they're Monero mining, which doesn't seem super, like, on CPU, doesn't seem super profitable, makes it seem more likely that it's probably misdirection and, yeah, giving instant responders an easy answer.
Don't dig too far, we're idiots, is basically the signal that they're trying to send, which, you know.
Makes a lot of sense.
Clever. Meanwhile, same crew has a bit of macOS malware that's been caught in the wild as well, like an updated version.
Yeah, they've updated some of their macOS kind of backdoors trojans that they've been using. This one is being delivered by a mechanism that makes it look like it's for use domestically in Vietnam, which is interesting, I guess, if the same crew's operating externally and internally. You know, I guess they're, you know, a country that's got, you know, a good crew, makes sense to use it everywhere. But yeah, the focus on macOS in you know, by this crew is interesting because it's not something we necessarily see everywhere. So, yeah. It's good work, I guess.
It's on brand when you think about it. You know, a communist nation owning the decadent MacBooks of the bourgeois. what have we got here? This is a really depressing read. Hunger relief group in Philadelphia called Philabundance lost $1 million in a BEC scam.
Yeah, that's just, it's super rough to read. You know, charitable organizations getting compromised in any way is bad enough. But yeah, this was...
but like a hunger relief charity during a pandemic? Oh,
yeah, and it was the payment for like building their kitchen.
Yeah.
And they got scammed for $1 million, which is, it's just really rough. And I, you know, it's just, yeah, it's gross. And
I mean, as much as we've talked about the need to mobilize certain agencies to target, I mean, look, BEC is a big problem. It is not as bad as ransomware, okay? It just isn't. But that said, it is still a very, very serious crime type. Ransomware is just very particularly critical, right? But I think just everything we're seeing with ransomware, where, you know, you and I have talked about, you know, non-law enforcement based approaches to that, then you look, you start looking at stories like this and bringing that in, folding them into your understanding of, you know, how everything's going. And you just think maybe we just need a major rework of how cybercrime is disrupted just generally. You know, maybe we do need some sort of multilateral alliance where operators from these countries can target these guys and disrupt them. And I think we need to move beyond traditional law enforcement when it comes to dealing with this stuff.
I mean, you know, I'd like to disagree because, you know, law enforcement is the right mechanism and all that. But yeah, you're right, right? I mean,
you know what we need? We need the world's cyber cops.
Yes. I mean, this is the, you know, the idea of cyberspace as a separate place outside of the jurisdiction of, you know, the, you know, that's the kind of the original hippie vision of a lot of it. And there is elements of truth in that, right? It is very hard to exert your laws and exert your, you know, your will in terms of how you, you know, deal with this kind of crime in the cyberspace because of all the, you know, the complexities of actually doing it. And it, yeah, it does perhaps make sense to have another way because it's just not working at the moment, right? So we're going to have to do something.
Did you just call it the cyberspace?
I did call it the cyberspace because, you know.
There's only one of them.
I'm full cyber now. I've just accepted it. I've drunk the cybers.
Cyber, 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 cyber. Mushroom. Anyway. What have we got? And yeah, the FBI pumped out a bulletin dealing with Beck. But I mean, this is what I mean, right? Like the FBI putting out a bulletin saying you should pay attention to your email forwarding rules. Like that's not going to fix this.
No, it's not, right? And yeah, it's just, you know, the current approaches have not been very effective. And yeah, telling people to look at their Outlook, you know, web access rules. Yeah, not going to make a difference to a charity that's building a kitchen. Because why should they? Why should they have to, you know, be at the forefront of the, you know, of computer security just to pay a bill, you know?
Yeah. Meanwhile, there have been some arrests in Nigeria. Three members of the so-called TMT cybercrime group. These guys they do malware-driven BEC, the sort of stuff that hit that charity in Philly. They have been done, which is nice.
Yeah, which is good. I mean, obviously, that was a pretty big group. So seeing three of them round up is, you know, is a good start. But obviously, there's a lot of other people involved. But I mean, anything that, you know, because the law enforcement takes so long, you know, it's always nice to see that there is still, you know, some outcome at the end of it, even if we are kind of frustrated by the pace of it.
Yeah, I like the picture they've included here, which shows a couple of these guys in cuffs surrounded by dudes carrying, you know, very big guns. So that's nice. Yep. That's satisfying. The US Supreme Court is finally, like, this has been coming for a while, but the US Supreme Court is looking at a case that could have big implications for the CFAA. In particular, the question that they're looking at is what authorized versus unauthorized means according to the CFAA, like that whole thing should be considered. So we can probably expect a judgment in this one soon, relatively soon anyway.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a long time coming. I mean, the CFAA has always been a butt of quite a lot of criticism, because of its age, because of its broadness and the way that it's interpreted by, the local, district attorneys and all those kind of people involved in prosecuting under it. This particular case...
Well, it seems like you get pretty inconsistent rulings too. Just when it comes to things like terms of service violations and is that hacking? Is this hacking? I think that's the question they're considering, right? What is hacking and what is just being naughty in other ways?
Yeah, because I mean, this particular case revolves around like a law enforcement officer that was being bribed to kind of look up stuff in, a law enforcement database of some sort, and whether or not that constituted hacking in the sense of accessing in excess of his authority. And there's the kind of lines of questioning so far from the judges in the Supreme Court have been, pretty critical sounding of the CFAA, but it is also, we're going to have to wait and see what the actual judgment in this particular case looks like.
Because, the reason it's gone to the Supreme Court is because it's actually hard, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, so you're right. It's been a long time coming, but just because there are so many different ways to interpret it, it's good to see it going to the Supreme Court for some clarity. So let's see what happens. There are, now speaking of terms of service violation, this is probably my favorite story of the week. A guy called Ned Williamson, who actually works for Project Zero, published a blog post about how they were trying to reverse engineer COD, the game, and they got detected by the anti-cheat and their account got nuked, and now Ned is sad.
I mean, I feel for you, guy. I do. I feel for you. On the other hand, like, what did you think was going to happen if you, attached WinDPG to Call of Duty and start dumping its RAM and stuff? Yeah, I mean, Activision's got all sorts of sneaky anti-cheat stuff. They don't want you up in there cheating. But yeah, I mean, obviously he wasn't there writing cheats. He's looking for sweet, sweet, remote multiplayer zero day or whatever. But yeah, I mean... what can you say? Like, I feel sad for the guy because having your account banned, like, that is kind of sad. He can't play Call of Duty anymore.
It is. And he's like, hey, they should open this stuff up for, for security researchers and stuff. And it's like, dude, you got dinged by anti-cheat, okay? And some of the people who work on this anti-cheat stuff, like, Marissa, she was on Risky Biz a couple of years ago, talking about, and she is smart, right?
Yeah.
And that was a hobby for her, was looking at anti-cheat. And then she wound up, after she did a conference talk at B-Sides, and then she was on Risky Biz, and clearly just a very, very smart woman. And she was recruited to work for a games company, I think in Canada, one of the big ones, and works on anti-cheat. But you would not want to go up against her, right? Do you know what I mean? Like, you're going to get snapped. It doesn't matter.
I mean, this is, the anti-cheat stuff is honed in fire, right? I mean, it's much like... set-top box, satellite hacking and stuff. Like, there is an arms race has been going on for a long, long time. And if you want to go, stick your hand in, in the anti-cheat, you're going to get a little bit,
you're going to stick your hand in the anti-cheat hornet's nest, you are going to get stung. But Ned, I hope you get your account back, buddy. And, that you can go frag some noobs.
Yes.
Because that's what we all like. Staying with gaming.
Shell some noobs, maybe.
Shell some noobs. Well, that was what he was trying to do, so. Yeah. But, no more debugging. No more debugging. Or at least use a throwaway account. Come on. What do we got here? Another one from Lorenzo over at Motherboard. And they were contacted by someone who said, look, we can find the email address associated with Xbox Live gamer tags. And Lorenzo, threw some tags at this person. And sure enough, they could. So that's interesting. Nice little bug there.
Yeah, apparently there was a bug in the web app that runs the Xbox Live enforcement website where you can report, cheating and whatever other bad stuff happening in game systems. So yeah, it's kind of ironic, I suppose, that if that was where, there was a way to dox people out of. So yeah,
that's a pretty critical bug for something like Xbox Live, right? Because we were just talking about Call of Duty. You ever play that game and listen to the crazy teenagers yelling at each other that they're going to kill each other and stuff?
Yeah,
you probably don't want your email address falling into those sort of hands. So that's good that one's been disclosed. Now, this one is not, you know, particularly a big deal, but the reason I wanted to talk about it is because, you know, we look at all of the headlines every week, and I'm seeing versions of this story pop up pretty regularly now, which is malicious NPM packages. Now, these are not a new thing. They've been around for a while. But as I say, the tempo of these stories is increasing, and I think we could start to see a flood of this stuff next year. But talk us through this story, Adam.
Yeah, so this story is about someone who had been putting up some malicious packages in the NPM repo. This, you know, purported to be like a library for handling JSON or whatever, and it had, you know, a Trojan in it that would call home when you install the package. So a pretty, you know, normal sort of malicious package we've seen in that. But yeah, the ecosystem as a whole, you know, that kind of open source supply chain has been problematic for a while. I think,
but
what's good about
it hasn't been tested yet, and that's the thing that I find interesting. Like, there hasn't been. They haven't faced these threats at their full volume, right? And I feel like that might be coming.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. And I was going to say, one of the positive things about this is that this was spotted pretty quickly. So people are looking, which is good. And perhaps that's one of the reasons we haven't seen it explode quite as fast as you would expect. But, you know, there's just a variety of ways to do this kind of supply chain stuff. And we've seen it in all of the ecosystems. And yeah, you know, wherever it works and sticks, and the developers are prone to pulling in dependencies, you know, a lot and often and falling for this kind of stuff, yeah, we will see it escalate, I think. But yeah, it was reassuring that this was caught relatively quickly. Like, some of these packages, these two packages, only had like, you know, 100 plus downloads.
Were detected by Sonatype. So, but I mean, essentially you're talking about doing scanning, right? I mean, we're back to the same old AV style thing, right? Like, eventually there will be bypasses. Eventually people will get better at not getting snapped by things like Sonatype. And, you know, that's the part that worries me, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, you know, these patterns do repeat themselves in different places and different forums. And yeah, I do think you're right. If this ends up working well, then we will see it escalate, you know?
Yeah. Drupal has a dumb bug in it. Very old school sort of tar bug, which is like a directory traversal, essentially, isn't it, in tar, when you could extract things to whatever directory you want. That's basically the bug.
Yeah, there was a bug. They were using an old version of the archive tar library that had a couple of different bugs in it. One of them, I think, was a overwrite files through path traversal, and one was a deserialization code exec through serialized PHP objects. Nice. So both of those are bad, but I think this is, you know, that was a bug that was fixed, as I understand it, upstream in that library a while ago, but it hadn't yet been pulled down into Drupal, which, you know, supply chains, right? Hard.
I guess the reason I wanted to talk about this one is because things have switched back, right? So WordPress was very, very popular, then turned out to be an absolute horror show. So Drupal became kind of popular there for a while. WordPress is doing all right these days. I mean, WordPress core, pretty good.
Yeah, we haven't seen a lot of bugs, and certainly not, you know, code exec in this kind of style, you know, in WordPress core for a while.
But that's what I mean. You would not expect to see this type of bug in WordPress anymore.
No, you wouldn't. And yeah, it's indicative that they've done quite a bit of work on that ecosystem. And yeah, Drupal, I think, a little bit out of date, a little bit, you know, less fresh on their thinking, you know, on handling these kinds of, you know, these kinds of things. Because yeah, you know, we haven't had a really bad WordPress story in ages.
No. I mean, there's plenty of vulnerable extensions and stuff, but I mean, even the way they update things now, and like, you know, I don't know, WordPress have...
It was that unsolicited update, you know, where they would just push it out and people got salty because they got their stuff secured, you know, without their consent.
Well, I think I remember, you know, you and I talking about that at the time, and the problem with the automatic extension, you know, and plugin, automatic plugin updates is that, you know, if someone takes over the plugin repo and then just loads it up with malware, that might get, you know, automatically updated. But
ways to shell so many things.
Yeah, we haven't actually seen that yet, right? Which I'm kind of surprised. But let's not tempt fate. Let's move on. There is a 2FA bypass in cPanel, which will be devastating news to the 0.5% of cPanel admins who use 2FA.
Exactly right. People who have cPanel on the internet probably aren't the sort of people that use 2FA on their cPanel. So, yeah, I don't know if this is going to be, you know, a widespread source of compromise.
Because cPanel, when you saw cPanel back in the day, you'd just lick your lips, right? But is it still out there? Do people still use cPanel? I guess they would, right? Because it provides some basic functions that just other things don't do.
Yeah, I mean, there is this whole kind of, you know, low-level tier of, you know, shared hosting, cPanel-y, you know, type infrastructure that runs a whole bunch of small you know, the sorts of things that just haven't been touched in a long time.
You use the word infrastructure to describe things running cPanel.
Well, it's just, you know, there's a lot of, you know, small mom and pop, you know, web stores and websites and, you know, blogs and whatever else that, you know, have just been this way for 10, 15 years and probably don't have to FA on their cPanel. But yeah, there's still a lot of it out there. It's not quite as much of an internet kick me sign as it used to be, but, or it is, but for different reasons, right? I mean, the shared hosting in general is a thing that's a kick me sign as opposed to specifically cPanel like it used to be.
Yeah. Yeah. What else have we got here? Microsoft has kicked 18 malicious Edge extensions from its, you know, store or whatever. We're going to see more and more of this, right? Because I think we spoke about it like a couple of weeks ago that, you know, there's more and more malicious stuff for Edgeium popping up.
Yeah, and it makes sense, right? It's worked well in the Chrome store for attackers, you know, and it's worked well in other plugin sources. It makes sense that it's going to come to Edge. And, you know, the onus here is on Microsoft to, you know, whilst that platform is still pretty young, to stop it from turning into a trash fire for them. I mean, this is, you know, pretty basic stuff. People just pretending to be NordVPN or whatever else.
Yeah, and they're only springing up ads. It's not like the end of the world, right?
Yeah, but I mean, you know, it's been a real problem for, you know, for Chrome and Android, and you would hope that Microsoft will learn some lessons, you know, because they've got a chance, right, to learn from other people by virtue of not being at, you know, the front of the pile with Edge.
Well, mate, that's actually it for the week's news. Of course, it was, you know, Thanksgiving week in the United States last week. So, you know, not as much news being reported as usual. So we're actually running a bit short this week. But it was great to have you back on deck, my friend, and wonderful to talk about all of this stuff with you. And we'll do it again next week, which is our last show for the year.
Yeah, it's been an interesting year. A lot of stuff's happened. You know, it's been a lot of really interesting news, a lot of depressing news. And I'll look forward to wrapping up whatever's left of it next week.
Yeah, next week is we're going to do our part to kick 2020 into the sun by making it our last episode for the year. So it's one more marker towards 2021, which is going to be a good year, everyone. A good year.
Yes, a good year. Better than this one.
That was CyberCX's Adam Boileau there with a check of the week's security news. And yeah, just look, a quick note on the ransomware and hospital stuff. One thing I want to make clear is that I believe it is entirely possible we will start seeing the operators of botnets like TrickBot start to lash out and conduct destructive attacks for the hell of it. I mean, the TrickBot operators were observed saying they were going to do that. But as far as we can tell, it hasn't happened yet. It just hasn't happened yet. So yeah, I think people are jumping the gun and we need to wait and see what happens, in case you're wondering why I was getting a little huffy in the news section there. Now, before we get to this week's sponsor interview, we've got a few jobs to talk about very quickly. The Australian Federal Police is looking for technical officers and technical analysts to work in its cybercrime operations division. And the Police Bank is looking for a head of security in Sydney. The Police Bank has something like 75,000 account holders, only around 170 staff. So they're definitely a small bank. Honestly, running security for a bank that size sounds borderline relaxing. Details on all those roles are linked to from our newsletter. And of course, you can find the web edition of the newsletter linked to in this week's show notes. Okay, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now. And this week's edition of the Risky Business Podcast is brought to you by Okta. And Okta has become a pretty clear leader in the identity and access management space. These days, they are a $30 billion company. Okta's Executive Director of Cybersecurity is Mark Rogers, and he is our sponsor guest this week. But he's not here to talk about Okta stuff. Rather, he's here to talk about some observations he's been able to make as a member of the CTI League. The CTI League was founded earlier this year as the pandemic kicked off, and it describes itself as a global volunteer emergency response community, defending and neutralizing cybersecurity threats and vulnerabilities to the life-saving sectors related to the current COVID-19 pandemic. So yeah, they set about doing a bunch of unglamorous but helpful stuff, like notifying hospitals of glaring vulnerabilities in their perimeter devices, you know, coordinating phishing takedowns, just good workaday security busy work designed to, you know, to be in the public good. Now, 2020, as they say, has been a hell of a decade. So I thought we could talk to Mark about the changes the CTI League has seen over the year. And, you know, like, don't forget, like back in March, hospitals getting ransomware, that was noteworthy and kind of surprising. Now it's a deluge and it's happening all the time. So a lot has changed through the year. Here's Mark Rogers.
we spent a lot of the initial days of the CTI League doing things like looking for vulnerabilities in infrastructure and working out ways in which we could talk to the facilities and say, hey, you've got a vulnerability, which is actually a lot harder than you can imagine, because most places aren't generally very receptive to a strange hacker knocking on the door saying, hey, you've got a bunch of vulnerabilities.
Yeah. So we had to I've acted in that role before, where people would find stuff and then they'd approach someone who's less likely to get arrested. So they'd give it to me and I'd go off and have to, you know, so I've done those door knocks before, and they are quite frustrating at times.
Yeah. So we spend a lot of time doing that, and a lot of time looking at things like phishing attacks and other things that were going after basically everybody, but also targeting hospitals. So I think it's fair to say that hospitals were targeted all along. And as things of specific interest started to bubble up, like, for example, key pieces of research started to appear, we saw big upticks around those periods as of targeting against those kinds of facilities. And so,
yeah, so like when the Citrix stuff, the F5 stuff, the Pulse Secure stuff, the Fortinet stuff, like, so as all of those border device bugs started becoming known, so you reckon that's what tipped it into being a much bigger, more serious problem? Because, I mean, that tracks, you know, that makes sense.
It is possible, because certainly what we were seeing before was much more email-based stuff.
Yeah.
And much more what I'd call small-time stuff. But, you know, obviously pretty serious. There was a, you know, general background of things like ransomware attacks and stuff happening, but it wasn't until later on that everything just sort of exploded and went completely insane.
I think we saw the first signs of that. Like, I think our first show this year, we were saying like, hey, did anyone even notice, like, just around Christmas time, that Citrix bug, that looks pretty bad, that could be a problem. And that was it kind of set the tone for the year, didn't it? Because that was the first one to really be for these people to really take advantage of.
Well, and also, right, you know, the Citrix bug and the F5 bug, for example, they were the same bug.
Yeah.
And, you know, and we're looking at bugs that fit into tweets that are so low sophistication, like, hey, the 90s called and wants its bug back.
Yeah.
And I think that the challenge with that is you've got something that's super accessible and super impactful. Of course it's going to get used.
Yeah. Yeah.
Although, you know, there are other factors that were happening around that time as well. You know, around that time is also when you started to see some pretty solid vaccine candidates coming out. And so there was actually some interesting stuff worth stealing. And so I think that also drove an uptick in terms of some of the targeting.
That was state actors using those same bugs. I mean, you know, that wasn't ransomware related, was it? Or were the ransomware crews going after those companies because they held critical, because they were playing a critical role in the COVID response and would be more likely to pay because of the importance of their role in the response?
I think it was both, because you would often see things like data that had come out of some of these facilities being sold in marketplaces.
Mm.
And so you immediately know that's not a nation state, because a nation state generally isn't going to sell on anything that it's grabbed. So I think there was a mixture of both things going on.
So what, they'd sell the data, then drop ransomware, or?
Yeah, I mean, like, separating in some cases the loader that goes in and then provides access to the network and provides access to the data, and then the locking that happens maybe a little bit later on. Is it the same entity that's doing both? In some cases, I mean, it's not clear. A lot of these loaders are now being provided as a service.
Yeah. You know, well, there's even the term initial access broker, right? Like, that's the term for it. Yeah. That access is now being monetized in multiple ways, I guess, is what you're saying, right? So you can steal the data, sell it, you know, get the initial access, sell it to someone who wants to steal the data. They steal the data, sell it in a marketplace. They then on-sell that access to a ransomware crew who finishes the third stage of the monetization, right?
And it is all part of the same kind of spectrum and ecosystem. Think about this. You know, the Twitter attack was a classic example of somebody sold access, gained access, sold access, and then somebody else leveraged that access and did whatever attempt they could at monetizing it. And I think that's a common trend that we're now seeing, where the little boys are doing simpler attacks to try and gain access, and sell it off in these marketplaces, while the big boys are using their heavy tools, their more sophisticated loaders, etc., to gain access, but ultimately are selling on in the marketplace with somebody else monetizing, and they're trying to squeeze every bit of cash they can all the way along the chain out of these targets as they get in.
I mean, this stuff isn't necessarily new, right? The idea of having different people with different specialties doing it. But it feels like the marketplace, like the illicit criminal marketplace for this stuff, is just working a lot better than it used to. Do you think that's a fair statement?
I think that's absolutely true. I think it's become a lot more industrialized. I mean, we saw this years ago, like decades ago, with the banking Trojans and their industrialization of how they were making that stuff, advertising it on various channels and selling it on. So like you say, it's nothing new, but it's just, it feels that much more global and industrialized now. They're a well-oiled
and efficient
machine.
Well-oiled machine. It's certainly got a lot more efficient now. You know, ransomware has been a growing problem over the last couple of years. It certainly feels like it's got dramatically worse this year. You're in a position where you see a lot of this stuff. Do you agree that it's got dramatically worse this year?
I think it has. And I think there's two things that are making it worse. One is that everyone is so much more vulnerable. So, you know, one of the common vectors that gets used is an email with some shady document attached to it with a payload in it. There are so many lures that can be used to get someone to look at one of these emails and click on one of these attachments. Now, it's way easier to get people to do stuff, and that's driving it. But also, there is so much more desperation and value in the stuff that's out there that there's much more opportunity. If they'd dropped a piece of ransomware on a facility in a normal year, you know, the dialogue is likely to be a lot more different than this kind of this year, where people are literally, their lives are depending on the operation of these facilities. And they know that being shut down for any period of time is not only going to be noticed, but it's going to cause a huge problem wherever it happens. And I think that squishiness is being exploited by these guys.
Now, you and I were talking before we started recording this interview, and you know, it's my opinion that agencies like perhaps the CIA should get involved in tackling these issues. I mean, the problem is, you know, there's not much the FBI can do when a lot of these crews are based in what I'd call bulletproof jurisdictions like Russia. I also think Treasury sanctions against the people who are sponsoring these attackers and keeping them out of prison and preventing them from being extradited. I think sanctions against those people seems like a pretty good idea. You say that I'm discounting the possible role of the private sector in pulling together a meaningful response. Tell us more about that. Why am I wrong?
So, first of all, let me start by why I think you're right. I think ransomware is a global problem. Historically, if you look back at how we have dealt with prosecution of things like hacking, it's terrible. We have done a terrible job at prosecuting hacking, especially when it crosses international borders, because laws don't line up. And as you say, there are jurisdictions that simply don't care. And so getting penalties through that make a meaningful impact is really hard. So the only way we're going to solve this is if we come up with something that is either global or something that is powerful enough and painful enough to reach into those locations to really discourage the people who are doing it. And ransomware is exactly the same, only it's worse, because it's actually, you know, hacking wasn't as big a problem because there wasn't so much money behind it.
Exactly.
There wasn't so much driving.
Cry me a river for banks who lost money. You know what I mean? Like losing a bit of money, right, and building that into their margins, that's always been kind of the operating model for a bank. Even in the days where, even in the Wild West would get robbed, right, and they had enough profits to cover that. That's what a bank does. Ransomware is different. I mean, you're talking about schools, hospitals, universities, like critical infrastructure. It's just nuts.
And it doesn't have the complexity required in order to pull it off like a hack does. In many cases, it's just an example of firing an email into a target organization. Some innocent clicks on an attachment and boom, the whole thing goes off. It's really trivial in a lot of cases. And we haven't wrapped our arms around the problem. Now, where I think that the private sector can help is, one example we've seen from within the CTI League is that as we brought more and more different groups from the private sector together, we became exponentially more efficient at dealing with certain problems. Normally, the private sector is very siloed. You have individual researchers, individual companies who do great pieces of work on their own, but it's not very joined up. You know, the average piece of malware has 25 different names across 30 different companies.
Yeah.
And you can't even tell whether it's the same thing. Until we get joined up, we're really not going to make a big concerted impact on some of this stuff. But when we do get joined up, there is an impact. And there are private sector organizations like, for example, companies who act as backbones, companies who control DNS, companies who are providers for other industry silos and so on and so forth, who have access to information, signals and stuff that could be used in a meaningful way.
But I mean, we did actually see that, like shortly after the Cyber Command action against TrickBot, we saw the Microsoft action, which was interesting for a number of reasons. One of them being that essentially that was a template. It was an interesting template for action that pulled together, yeah, companies like running telco and backbone services, companies like Microsoft Cloud Platforms, everything. It sort of, you know, they were able to go to the courts and get authorized to perform a bunch of actions that could have a meaningful impact, not just against TrickBot this time, but against all sorts of criminals in the future, right? So, yeah, that was interesting. But, I mean, do we know how effective either the Cyber Command action against TrickBot or the subsequent Microsoft action have, do we know how effective they've been?
It's not something I can quantify, but what I can say is that from within the league, watching the campaigns that we've pulled apart and taken down, obviously most of which are a lot smaller than that, there has been significant impact. And I've watched as responders have been able to facilitate problem solving and triaging within institutions that are hit by some of the bigger things. And it's only through that cooperation that the alert was picked up, that the notification went out, that the engagement happened, and that the facility was helped. So I know that there's a lot of latitude to do this stuff, but this cooperation is happening in isolated pockets. We need to get it all together. And you're right that it needs to be agency-led, because the reality is the private sector doesn't have the remit or the authority to do any of this stuff. And so they need an agency, or they need federal guidance in doing it, plus some kind of policy oversight to make sure it's done right. But, you know...
But that's going to gum it up, right? Like, you know that that's going to gum up the works.
And that's the challenge, right? That's the problem.
I mean, CISA seemed to be doing all right on that front in terms of like baby steps towards that whole public-private cooperative model. I mean, were they useful through all of this?
CISA has been phenomenal. I have to say, working with CISA on a lot of different projects, they were dedicated, they were mission-oriented, and we didn't have any of the kind of challenges that you would expect from, say, a bureaucratic agency. They just got on and dealt with stuff. Really sad to see Chris Krebs move on, because he was one of the key facilitators in making a lot of really good stuff happen. But if you look at some of their output, take, for example, the joint notification they released on ransomware during the campaign against medical facilities. That remains probably one of the most coherent two pages on what you should do if you believe that you're under threat and how you should respond if you believe you've been impacted out of anything. That came out at the right time, in the right way. And my only disappointment was it didn't actually get pushed far enough, I think. I think the the private sector actually gummed that one up, but because everybody else wanted to have their comments and well, sort of stopped it from spreading.
That's right. It's like everybody wants to be a thought leader, right? Can't just take the straightforward information from DHS and pass it on. That will not do. All right, Mark Rogers, I guess what you're saying is that, you know, the private sector and the and governments will have to play a role here together.
Yeah, look, we're going to have to work together to wrap our arms around this problem. And honestly, we've only barely started to do that. You know, we've identified a few individual actors and a few individual campaigns, and we've done some damage, but we haven't really caused major disruption or driven significant fear into any of these operations. And that is what we're going to need to do, because right now the signals we are sending is that you can launch a massive ransomware campaign that would, in ordinary terms, be considered the equivalent of launching a cyber attack, and you can get away with it. And not only can you get away with it, you can drive off in your Ferrari.
Yeah.
And we need to stop that.
Yeah, indeed we do. Mark Rogers, thank you so much for joining us on the show to have a chat about all things ransomware. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
That was Mark Rogers of Okta there. Big thanks to him for that. And big thanks to Okta for sponsoring the Risky Business Podcast. We can't put this show together without our sponsors. You can find them, of course, at okta.com. And that is it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. I'll be back in the next few days with a soapbox edition featuring the founders of VMRay. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.